Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our last occasional lecture for the year. I was reading in the Canberra Times this morning about all the things and people who do well when it's raining and those who don't. And, of course, one of the people who do well are cinemas. And it's just occurred to me that, well, occasional lectures do very well when the weather's bad because we've got a great crowd here today. And I'm sure it's not just because it's raining. I'm sure it's because you want to hear Dr. David Heaton talk about his very interesting subject about the development of early Canberra. David Heaton's well known to all of us from, he's been a person in Canberra for a long time with an academic background, very strong interest in cultural and social history. So please welcome Dr. David Heaton today. Thank you.
Thanks, Rosemary, and thank you very much. I think the secret to it is that I'm talking about surveyors. That's what drew the crowd. I should, just in case you haven't seen it, I should give the title, which is Devotion, Daring and Sense of Destiny, Surveyors of the Early Commonwealth. During the decade that preceded Federation, the Australian colonies entertained a number of visiting dignitaries and international celebrities, curious about the former British convict gulag that had so spectacularly reversed its grim early fortunes. None of the visitors was as popular as the American writer and humorist Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain. In Australia, on a worldwide lecturing tour in 1895, because of some ill-chosen investments, Twain took an avid interest in Australian culture and Australian history. In the publication of his travels that followed soon after his southern sojourn, called Following the Equator, came out in 1897, Twain observed with characteristic flair, "Australian history is almost always picturesque. Indeed, it is so curious and strange that it is itself the chiefest novelty the country has to offer. And so it pushes the other novelties into second and third place. It does not read like history, but like the most beautiful lies. And all of a fresh new sort, no mouldy old stale ones. It is full of surprises and adventures and incongruities and contradictions and incredibilities. But they are all true. They all happened." When the many Australians who read Following the Equator over the next 100 years read this paragraph, they must surely have reflected with satisfaction and not a little pride on a succession of historic milestones. You can take your pick. The transformational Lachlan Macquarie years, for example. The opening up of the interior. John McDowell Stewart's epic quest. Lola Montez defiantly horsewhipping her newspaper critic in booming Ballarat. Eureka, the world firsts of the Australian labour movement, the sporting achievements of the cricketers, the rowers, Archer and Carbine, the Australian Constitution story, Federation itself, Gallipoli, Kokoda. Few of Twain's Australian readers would have considered the Canberra story, the birth of the national capital, on their list. And yet the creation of the capital city of the fledgling nation fits the creation story of the capital city of the fledgling nation fits Twain's description like a glove, especially the many yarns included in the grand narrative's first instalments. Opium addict, journalist and convict short story writer William Astley, for instance, determined to achieve continent-wide interest in the so-called Battle of the Sites to find the country's ideal capital. Australia's second Prime Minister, Alfred Deakin, Prime Minister on three separate occasions, holder of the reins of power through key national capital selection years, and yet a man more passionately attached to the idea of raising the dead than raising taxes. The third Prime Minister, Chris Watson, born in poverty on a ship in the bay of Valparaiso, Chile, destined to be the first Labor leader of a modern democracy, whose intervention for Canberra as the best capital site was based in part at least on his love of, and I see Greg Wood in the audience, his love of trout. The many tours of the enthused senators and reps to obscure mostly southern New South Wales towns and regions full of high-mindedness, high aspirations and sundry hijinks. The ridiculous number of votes in the House and the Senate that at one point gave the capital city nod to the snowy hamlet of Dalgetty in 1904 and at other confused and confusing moments to Tumut, to Bombala, and to the apple town of Batlow. The seemingly interminable process of locating a capital that exhausted 7 Commonwealth governments, 5 New South Wales governments, 2 Royal Commissions, 9 Commonwealth Ministers for Home Affairs, and involved 4 lapse bills and 3 acts of the Commonwealth Parliament. The courageous rebel Victorian Senator James Heer McColl, who turned an 18-18 deadlock Senate vote between Tumut and a hybrid concoction called Yass Canberra into a 1917 triumph, as Australia finally got a seat of government act in 1908 that would hold its place in favour of the hybrid. This was the result of a clever last-minute compromise, nearly last-minute compromise, thought up by Chris Watson and George Reid, Australia's 4th Prime Minister, and it carried the day, and just enough of the doubters. I could go on, and in fact, 2 years ago I did in a Senate lecture. There is little doubt that Twain's contradictions and incredibilities are everywhere apparent in the 2 lively decades of the emergent Canberra story up to the 14th of December 1908, when the necessary royal assent for the seat of government bill of 1908 made it law. But what of the surprises, the adventures, the incongruities that the American, Twain, so delights in? To locate them, we need today to turn our attention to the next instalment of the Canberra story. Less colourful, perhaps, but every bit as imposing and surprising. Chapter the second, if you like, which places an unlikely group, not so unlikely looking at the surveyors out here, the Commonwealth surveyors, into our main frame. The men that respected historian Laurie Fitzharding termed, with affection and admiration, the heralds of a new era. Now, with the utmost respect for the practical capabilities and talents of surveyors as a group, very conscious today, fair to say that theirs is hardly a profession with which one readily associates high adventure, surprises, and assorted incredibilities. Yet these are exactly what you get in the minutiae of the saga of Canberra's Commonwealth surveyors. Before I work into the argument of this paper, consider for a moment, and is Barbara Coe here by any chance? Is Bruce Coe here? I'm not sure she gets these leaflets, but I acknowledge Barb, who gave me some terrific work to enable me to have this in today's paper. Consider for a moment the spare facts surrounding Claude Stafford Vorton, the man apparently responsible for so much of the precious surveyor and broader community photographic record of Canberra's early history 100 years ago, including a number of those now iconic shots, genuinely iconic shots, atop the big ceremony podium, the Denmans, Andrew Fisher and King O'Malley, on the 12th of March 1913. Or rather, we think this cache of photographs was the work of Claude Stafford. The National Archives is of that opinion, not really sure, but basically has that opinion. However, the photos may just have been the work of his immensely skilled cartographer and photographer father, Ernest, who put a bullet in his head at the Randwick Rifle Range, aged 59, in 1916. The Canberra Vorton story, Claude Stafford and Ernest Stafford, gets a little curiouser when we explore their common lineage. One direct forebear, Claude Stafford's great-great-grandfather, Claude Theodore, was the aide-de-camp of Napoleon Bonaparte. A related descendant, it appears, is one Paul Fatty Vorton, proud Queenslander, former Australian rugby league footballer and Channel 9 football show host. Surprises, incredibilities indeed. I have a few more in store. In this lecture, I'll focus on a selection of the surveyors' centenary stories, those men and their pioneer wives who between 1909-10 and 1915 camped on the limestone plains and in the nearby Brindabellas and Southern Alps in order to survey the city within and the border of the new Federal Capital Territory, as it would be called at its commencement date, coming up the centenary, the 1st of January 1911. The FCT perimeter measured out a very big border. Surveying it accurately took years, and loads of ingenuity, devotion, and yes, even a little daring. Weather and water loomed large. Lifelong friendships were forged. Characters abounded, egos too. These surveyors a century ago had a keen sense of their role in the nation-building project. In Canberra, over a seven-year period, a period during which Australia became embroiled in the Great War, World War I, the surveyors undertook a specialist task. In the course of carrying it out, they rubbed shoulders and shared their fires and their camps with like-minded Commonwealth and state politicians, geologists, meteorologists, astronomers, engineers, architects, and military men. All of them relished the chance to be a part of something far bigger than themselves, a part of an endeavour destined to exert a lasting impact on the generations of Australians to come. In today's paper, I'll first recall a long-forgotten conference of Australian professional men that took place in Melbourne in 1901, a gathering which helps us to place the surveyors in cultural and industry context. Second, I'll go into some necessary detail about the premier surveyor of his generation, Charles Robert Scrivener, his character, his influence, his aura, and his commanding role in the early Canberra story. Next, I'll clarify the facts of the broader surveyor narrative, the other men of significance involved, and the reasons why they were rightly regarded at the time as the heralds of a new era. Fourth, and finally, I will place these men amongst their professional and political peers in Canberra during a period of years pre-World War I, acknowledged and welcomed at the time as being consciously, programmatically nation-building. As Prime Minister Gillard searches for ways to formulate and progress a big-ticket issue agenda for 2011, she could do a lot worse than use as a benchmark for action the determination and courage of her Labor Party centenary predecessor, Prime Minister Andrew Fisher, who 100 years ago made gutsy decisions for his adopted country that left a lasting legacy. To gain some insight into the cultural milieu into which we placed the first Commonwealth surveyors, we need to go back a few years before the watershed year 1909, back to 1901, the year of Federation. When the first Commonwealth Parliament was opened in Melbourne on the 9th of May, just down the road in Collins Street and running for a full fortnight from the 6th of May to the 17th of May, a meeting of design and building professionals was already underway. The event's full title was the Congress of Engineers, Architects, Surveyors and others interested in the building of the Federal Capital of Australia. The design of Australia's new capital, all the participants agreed, was far too important to leave solely to the politicians. Experts must be called in on this matter of national significance, and the Congress was organised to signal just such intent. Two resolutions were adopted by the Congress. The first, that design professionals must be fully involved in the selection of the site. That was inevitable. And a second, more portentous resolution, which needs to be quoted in full. In the opinion of this Congress, it is important that the federal capital should be laid out in the most perfect manner possible, and that to avoid the mistakes made in many cities of spoiling the plan by utilising existing buildings, it is desirable that in any site obtained, all obstructions be removed that would in any way prevent the adoption of the most perfect design. There would be times in the years ahead when certain politicians, Labor and non-Labor alike, agitated for a down market, narrowly utilitarian, wattle and daub, that was Deakin's phrase, wattle and daub capital. But for the most part, and at certain key moments, high aspiration was in the ascendant. All 13 papers presented at the Congress restated a commitment to, what I guess we'd say today, pretty cliched, but world's best practice design. In his opening address, George Higgins purposefully recalled the splendour of Daniel Burnham's White City Pavilions at the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893. It had only been some 8 years earlier. Throughout his paper, Higgins addressed Australia's unique opportunity to build a model city, an ideal city, and his introductory words set the elevated tone for what followed. 2 points about this timely meeting need to be made. Well, you can make many, but I'll only make 2 today. the fact that the first two papers in the published proceedings were by surveyors, ahead of the engineers, architects and what today we might call landscape architects. And second, there was no sign of any grandstanding by any of the professions. What do I mean by that? Well, in the 20 or so years preceding the conference and in the decade following it, heated debate amongst the professions continued virtually unabated as to which one was best suited to lead the relatively new science of town planning. The architects would make the most audacious international bid for this premier status at the first International Town Planning Conference in London in October 1910. Of course, we've just come through that centenary. But there was no sign of any such antipathy amongst the Australians in Melbourne. All sang from the same song sheet, endorsed the same aims for the new nation's capital, and applied themselves to the task of articulating the role to be played by their particular profession. Surveyor R. Henson Broadhurst anticipated a very real problem to emerge in Canberra 10 years later when he stated that the surveyor, bearing in mind the trouble and litigation continually proceeding in the existing cities owing to the imperfections of the original surveys, proposes to himself that in the new city the surveys shall be accurate and the marking permanent. It would be precisely the lack of such accuracy in the 19th century surveys of the Canberra region that continually undermined the work of the border surveyors. But more of that shortly. Surveyor Broadhurst, in delivering a paper of technical quality concerned with the laying out of the Commonwealth capital and emphasising the importance of such issues as sanitation, street width and intersection design, reflected the spirit of the gathering. He concluded by expressing his desire to see the Congress's collective efforts bear fruit in the improvement of the new city, to which, as he put it, we all hope to be able to point with pride as the outcome of Australian intelligence, aided by the experience of all ages. In the exhibition which I've curated with the same title as this lecture, to be launched in the presiding officer's gallery of this magnificent building on the 17th of December, 2 weeks today at 11 o'clock, a copy of the rare Congress proceedings is on display, along with Charles Coulter's iconic watercolour of an imagined Lake George capital city looking to all the world like our own Venice. The Melbourne Congress proceedings booklet included a black and white reproduction of Coulter's ideal city. It's a testament to the impact of the 1901 Congress that within a week of the Seat of Government Act of 1908 being written into law, the Minister for Home Affairs in the Fisher Labor Government, Hugh Mann, issued a set of visionary instructions to District Surveyor Charles Scrivener. The capital city to come would start with the contribution of the surveyors. That was inevitable. We will never know who wrote those instructions. Might have been Mann. Greg was talking about it. Could have been Scrivener. We're not going to know that. But we do have a pretty fair idea of what the writer had been reading. Channeling the 1901 Congress, Minister Mann challenged his district surveyor thus, possibly the best known words other than Griffin's in the Canberra story. The surveyor will bear in mind that the federal capital should be a beautiful city, occupying a commanding position with extensive views and embracing distinctive features which will lend themselves to the evolution of a design worthy of the object, not only for the present, but for all time. While Mann would soon drop out of my narrative, the recipient of his instructions, Charlie Scrivener, was destined to fulfil a noble role. In the 7 or so years following 1908, arguably the leading role on our national capital stage. Charles Robert Scrivener was born in 1855 in modest circumstances, depending on who you read, in either Windsor or Canterbury, but certainly around or in Sydney. At age 21, he was appointed by the New South Wales Colonial Secretary as a cadet in the trigonometrical branch of the New South Wales Surveyor General's Office. Made a staff surveyor in 1901, Scrivener impressed his peers with an extraordinary work ethic, a passion for field work, the more rugged the terrain the better, and meticulous attention to detail. Pretty typical of surveyors, I would have thought. But maybe more so. These qualities were recognised both in New South Wales and by those in the emergent Commonwealth Public Service who required a level of surveying skills commensurate with the national scale of the tasks ahead. So when Prime Minister Deakin adopted a proactive stance on the capital issue in the first months of 1904, it was to Scrivener and to his surveyor colleague A.H. Chesterman that he turned to investigate site options in the Southern Alps and surrounding districts. Chesterman inspected 10 sites around Tumut, a couple of which, incidentally, are magnificently represented in Monty Luke's photographs in the exhibition in 2 weeks' time. Scrivener, on the other hand, looked at a range of sites in the southern Monaro, among them the town of Dalgety. During a parliamentary recess, Scrivener, District Surveyor Scrivener, was joined by the Prime Minister himself, keen to have a closer look at Bombala and Dalgety. Shortly after, Scrivener entertained two more VIPs, the former long-time Premier of Western Australia, renowned explorer, Federal Government Minister John, later Sir John Forrest, whose wonderful Historic Memorials Committee painting will also be on display, courtesy of the Parliament House collection, coming up. So Forrest and former Boer War staff officer, there's going to be a sort of an ongoing theme here with the Boer War, as you'll find out in a moment, and former Boer War staff officer and Inspector General of Works in the Home Affairs Department, Percy Owen. Undoubtedly, we're going to give Percy Owen's story, give that a run in the next year or two. Scrivener had begun rubbing shoulders and sharing fires with the nation's leadership. He made a deep impression on them at the time, and they wouldn't forget it. When the time came to survey in more detail the selected Yass Canberra site at the beginning of 1909, it was to Scrivener once again that this time the Labor Party looked. Deakin, Forrest and Owen so loudly sang his praises as the only possible choice that Fisher opted for him despite the recommendation coming from the other side of the political divide and, more relevantly, despite the genuinely impressive claims of several New South Wales government surveyors, including Arthur Lloyd, who had done so much of the substantive work in the years from 1905 to 1907, and he's been mentioned already. Obviously, we went trout fishing only last weekend. Greg Wood highlighted this in his recent exhibition at the National Library, entitled Far Sighted, and he's done so in one or two National Library of Australia news articles as well. Many years later, coinciding with the opening of the Provisional Parliament House in May 1927, Colonel Percy Owen OBE discussed the roots of the Canberra story in a delightful memoir for the Sydney Morning Herald. He recalled with fondness the 1904 excursion in which he participated. The delegation traversing the Victorian countryside, Crowajingalong, Delegate, Bombala, Buckley's Crossing, the old name for Dalgety, Kyandra, Yarangabilly Caves, Gadara near Batlow, and Tumbarumba. Owen vividly remembered the campfire chats, full of anecdote, poetry, and reminiscences, as he put it. For Owen, Charlie Scrivener simply excelled. As he put it, a man eminent in his profession and with a thorough knowledge of the region selected by the Parliament. I met him in Melbourne and travelled in his buggy with a pair of horses. Scrivener had a strong personality. He was frugal, he was indomitable, a martinet, but withal genial and lovable. This is about as complete and insightful a summary of the man as we get from any source. For his part, the experience Scrivener personally gained in 1904, imposing his character on and influencing men of considerable ability and, more importantly, perhaps, real political power, these would serve him well when the succession of political delegations to Canberra began in earnest in the first months of 1909 and continued right up to his retirement in 1915. Acting quickly on Mahon's detailed instructions, on Mahon's detailed set of instructions for the capital, in the first weeks of 1909, and with characteristic efficiency, Scrivener produced a preliminary report on the Yass Canberra site by the 25th of February. He remained lukewarm about the extended site as a whole, but, as he wrote, he regarded the Canberra site as the best that can be obtained, being prominently situated and yet sheltered, while facilities are afforded for storing water for ornamental purposes at a reasonable cost, unquote. Furthermore, a capital in Canberra, he wrote, would probably lie in an amphitheatre of hills with an outlook towards the north and northeast. Walter Burley Griffin enthusiasts in the audience might now recognise perhaps the American source for his much-quoted remark about Canberra's mountain panorama. The first page of Scrivener's handwritten preliminary report, I should add, is in the exhibition courtesy of the National Archives of Australia. When establishing the first surveyor's camp in Canberra in February 1909, Scrivener did so in consultation with Minister McMahon, and Colonel David Miller. Miller, like Owen, served in the Boer War as an officer, in his case, with the Imperial Bushmen's Contingent. He was appointed as the first secretary of the Commonwealth Department of Home Affairs in November 1901, and he would remain in that position for over a decade until he was appointed as the first administrator of the new Federal Capital Territory in late 1912. Miller was an intimidating government bureaucrat and an uncompromising adversary. Surveyor Arthur Percival, about whom we are about to hear more, remembered Miller in two words a lot of years later: gruff and frightening. This seems to have been the common consensus about Miller. He's due for a paper as well. Scrivener, Mahon and Miller chose the first surveyor camp on Currajong Hill, where we are, now Capitol Hill, on the 2nd of March, 1909. A matter of days later, the Federal City Members Camp, as it was called, was established nearby as a base for the first visiting delegation of politicians, the first of many, as I've said. Boer War veteran Colonel Miller, it appears, ran the camp with rigid discipline. One of the 17 participating parliamentarians, New South Wales MHR Jimmy Katz, a great mate of King O'Malley's, laconically observing at the time that, if there is one special feature about the camp, it is its strictly business appearance and military setting. The camp is recreated for us in a series of postcard photographs taken at the time by the Yass printing firm of Howard and Shearsby, all of which are reproduced in the exhibition to come. If the politicians were whipped into line by the frightening Miller, they could at least gain some temporary pleasure from the meals produced by their imported parliamentary chef. Life was not nearly as salubrious for Scrivener's mob a stone's throw away. They, like their leader, worked 16 hours a day, every day, for two solid months to assist in the production of what is usually referred to as Scrivener's second report, dated 22 May 1909. It's hardly surprising that a board appointed by Minister Mahon in March 1909 fully endorsed the controversial report, because the Board of Mates appointed comprised Colonel Miller, Lieutenant Colonel Owen, by then the Director General of Public Works, Colonel Walter Liberty Vernon, the New South Wales Government architect and yet another Boer War vet, and Scrivener himself. Conflict of interest protocols, it seems, were not a strong suit in the first years of the Commonwealth Public Service. Scrivener had a veritable army of supporters in place for his work, a clique of colonels. Time does not allow me to cover the issues raised by the report in any detail. However, it's clear from Scrivener's correspondence that the water storage issue always loomed largest for him, as it did for Forrest, and Deakin was very conscious of it. Virtually all of the key people were highly conscious, certainly, and perhaps most importantly, Scrivener himself. In his second report, he rejected the water flow estimates for the Cotter River, supplied by the authoritative voice of New South Wales Chief Engineer for Harbours and Water Supply, E.M. de Burgh, who incidentally gets a great run from Owen in the 1927 article, which is interesting. But Scrivener opposes him. A robust correspondence resulted from the New South Wales and Commonwealth governments as bureaucrats from both sides pored over the water catchment statistics of the Canberra site in minute detail. This exchange is given an extra layer of complexity that I think we can identify with when, despite the seat of government act of 1908, I'll just backtrack a bit. An extra layer of complexity, when you factor in that the government of Alfred Deakin took over from Fisher right in the middle of it in May 1909, and a further layer of complexity, when despite the seat of government Act 1908 and despite the busy, focused activity of Scrivener's team, their work ethic, throughout the second half of the same year, we're now post-1908, post the decision, the anti-Canberra lobby in the federal parliament, made up mostly of Victorian politicians sensing for the first time that the capital might actually leave their state, mischievously expanded their militant efforts to quash the seat of government act. For the second time. Yet despite the chronic insularity of much parliamentary discussion at that time, Prime Minister Deakin and his Home Affairs Minister George Fuller were committed to establishing the first infrastructure of the chosen capital site. Hence, on the 6th of December 1909, with the New South Wales land package having finally been gifted to the Commonwealth, Minister Fuller alerted his leader to a pressing practical issue. The need now to have, as he wrote, territorial boundaries accurately determined on the ground. The acquisition of land in private hands by the Commonwealth must proceed in a dignified, organised way. Both Fuller and Deakin refused to countenance anyone but Scrivener for the delicate job ahead. Certainty and precision were essential for all parties. Fuller appointed Scrivener as the first Director of Commonwealth Lands and Surveys. For his part, Scrivener was set on getting exactly the men he wanted, and in consultation with Miller, he got them. Quality individuals such as Percy Sheaf, who started the border survey at Mount Coree in wintry June 1910, worked on it, accompanied by his wife, for the next 3 years under exacting conditions, and eventually became a chief surveyor. Happy Harry Mowat, the man who rarely smiled, but who worked assiduously on the border survey from October 1913 to May 1915, and who would later become the Commonwealth Property Officer. Fast Freddie Johnston, proud owner of one of the FCT's first cars, it was a Model T Ford in case you're interested, who surveyed the border for 3 months in 1915 and who eventually became the Commonwealth's fourth Surveyor General. And Arthur Percival, who mostly is Sally Pryor in the audience, by any chance? Jeff is. Okay, I didn't think you were coming, Jeff, and welcome. And I was given permission to say this too. And Arthur Percival, who worked on the technical aspects of the city survey and who was appointed to the role of Commonwealth Surveyor General in 1929 and served for a lengthy 15-year period. On the 8th of January 1910, stick with me on the dates, so 1910, the first camp, we're now second camp and the important one, the Federal City Survey Camp was established on the site of the 1909 camp, here, pretty much, just over there. Sheaf, I think if I've got my directions right, I think I have. Sheaf and Percival joined Scrivener's team from different directions on the 19th of January. The sum of technical tasks, I don't begin to understand them, confronting the relatively small group, has been well summarised by Scrivener biographer Terry Birtles. A triangulation survey of the territory, preparation of the close contour survey, demarcation of the territory boundary and water catchments, engineering surveys for water supplies, sewerage pipes, roads, the railway and bridges, confirmation of cadastral boundaries of privately owned land to be acquired, and pegging out of land boundaries at Jervis Bay. Progress was swift. By the end of February, nearly 24 miles in the transverse of the survey was completed. 94 miles of contours had been defined, a meteorological station established, and instruments installed to gauge creek flow and evaporation. In March, 17 tonnes of building material had arrived for construction of temporary premises. The first wave of essential Commonwealth infrastructure was off to a flyer, in the hands of a group united by common purpose and collectively devoted to the work in hand. We have an excellent feel for this Scrivener working camp, courtesy of several sources. The classic photographs taken by Claude Vorton, we think, the governor photographer, as Scrivener called him in letters, who so elegantly captured the men, their wives and partners and the times in a number of black and whites, both posed and not, and virtually all of them will be on show in the exhibition. The letters to his children of prolific letter writer and caring, doting father, Charlie Scrivener, particularly to his daughter, Ethel. The diaries of Arthur Percival, still in the possession of the family, two of them, I'm pleased to say, on display in the exhibition, and all of them presently being transcribed by Percival's grandson, Geoff Prior. Doesn't need any further explication. And, of course, the plethora of government correspondence and Hansard transcripts, which are readily available. Percy Owen would recall that, as he wrote, the camp in time became comfortable and was always a joy. The party was not big. Scrivener, his assistants, the cook and chain men, and for a while, a full-grown black snake under the floor of Scrivener's tent. That snake did not survive long. The bush humour alive in the camp undoubtedly contributed to its smooth running and esprit de corps. There is a terrific photo in the exhibition of two visiting senators, I'm sure many or maybe most of you know it, of two visiting senators to the camp, J.J. Long and Arthur Ray, hamming it up for the cameras as they mock shape up, Marcus of Queensbury style, to demonstrate their conflicting views on the capital site's merits. Also on show in the exhibition is an enlarged copy of the front page of the then Daily Telegraph broadsheet, featuring an article entitled "With the Senators at the Yass Canberra Federal Capital Site." We learn that one delegation of senators embarked on a two-day tour of inspection of the Canberra site on the 26th and 27th of July 1910. The group included, as the Sydney paper put it, and typical of the times, a few Victorian malcontents, determined still to sink the Canberra site if possible. The majority of those present, however, were in agreement with one of their fellow senators when he declared to an accompanying journalist that, to quote him directly, "to resurrect the capital site question now is nothing short of political body snatching." This same group had a comic mishap on the second day of their visit, lapped up by the media, when New South Wales Senator Alan McDougall, being rowed by the ever-vigilant Scrivener across a particularly frisky Cotter River, I'm sure it's like that now, found himself, along with the experienced and wilderness-wise Commonwealth Director of Lands and Surveys, in, not on, the Cotter. Months later, when Senator McDougall presented his report on the Canberra visit to the Senate on the 15th of September, he admitted to being, as he put it, greatly surprised at the roaring stream which I saw at the junction of the Cotter and the Murrumbidgee. And then, more surprised, he found himself actually testing at first hand the quality of said water. The Daily Telegraph reporter noted in passing that Mr. Scrivener gave a fine example of a backward somersault into the water, and that Senator McDougall, once he'd arrived at the bank and was swathed in a huge rug, provided a fine impersonation of a Maori chief. The Daily Telegraph pictures that accompanied the article effectively caught the spirit of proceedings, while the hirsute appearance of virtually all of the senators in a sizeable group photograph would surely have had each and every one of them highly competitive in our thankfully concluded 2010 month of November. But it was not all smiles, humour and hijinks. Far from it. At various points in his diaries, Arthur Percival refers to grafting hard, meaning, of course, the hard work in hand. Mr. Surveyor Percival enjoyed a punt, a smoke and a quiet reflective whisky. But such methods of relaxation were thinly interspersed between exhausting, non-stop toil. In Percival's case, for example, we know that a standard day was 7:30 a.m. to 6:15 p.m. and then 8 to 11 every day. This surely was devotion above and beyond the call of duty. On the border, Sheaf worked just as hard, in even more demanding terrain. In places, Sheaf wrote many years later, the country encounter was so rough that the party carrying out the survey had to crawl on all fours, measure over precipices, and descend in 1 mile about 1,550 feet. Two of Sheaf's original field books on display in the exhibition confirm the validity of this memory virtually down to the last inch. And thanks to Alex Petro for that. They're going to be splendid in the exhibition. And yet this didn't stop Sheaf reminiscing in later age that the National Capital chapter of his life was his most treasured and certainly his most significant achievement. In his article on Canberra, entitled Selection and Design, that appeared in a Sydney Morning Herald supplement to mark the opening, again in 1927, the opening of the Provisional Parliament House down the road, Sheaf probably voiced the sentiments of all of his surveyor colleagues who worked on the National Capital in the first years when he rather sagely wrote, "As the home reflects the occupier, so Canberra should reflect the Australian people. Its growth is our responsibility. Great as the responsibility is, let us resolve with grit and determination that the best traditions of our race should be upheld." If any of you hear an echo of that of Fisher in 1913, I suspect it was still in Sheaf's head. Sentiments such as these relentlessly drove a generation of professional men, and what for the most part were their female partners, of course, for the nature of the times, in the nation-building years in Canberra prior to the Great War. Not only the surveyors, but those with whom they regularly engaged on big national projects. Griffith Taylor, his theodolite will be in the exhibition and in his Antarctic box in which it was kept, Griffith Taylor was one. A leading 20th century internationally recognised geographer, celebrated Antarctic explorer, protégé of the legendary Professor T.W. Edgeworth David, mate of the even more legendary Douglas Mawson, and for our purposes today, brilliant, if eccentric, physiographic surveyor of the Federal Capital Territory. Thomas Griffith Taylor had a lifelong interest in his nation's capital city. He took to heart the life lessons inculcated into him by his mentor, Professor David. Namely, saturate yourself with as much learning and specialist training as you can get and put those skills, when ready, to work for the nation. So when the call went out from Melbourne in the first years of the new century for physiographic surveyors to study the meteorological and physiographical qualities of the competing capital sites, Taylor's hand was one of the first in the air. He wrote his first scholarly article on Canberra in 1907 and followed this up with superb and extremely detailed analyses of Canberra's geography in 1910 and again in 1914. Taylor's work had seamless connections with the brand new Commonwealth Bureau of Meteorology. Throughout 1906, the House of Representatives in particular witnessed a series of high-quality debates on meteorology and on weather. Andrew Fisher, Joseph Cook, two prime ministers, John Forrest and James Heer McColl were just a few of the parliamentarians who took an intense interest in the subject and its application to a future capital ahead of the formation of the Bureau. This interest was the catalyst for the appointment of Henry Ambrose Hunt on the 1st of January 1907 as the first Commonwealth meteorologist. Griffith Taylor and a man called E.T. Quayle would only a few years later collaborate with Hunt to produce a landmark volume, The Climate and Weather of Australia, published in our big year, 1913, the very first Australian textbook on what one contemporary South Australian newspaper memorably described, and I thank Barbara Coe for this, as the romance of the upper air. Hunt, Taylor and Scrivener saw a great deal of Pietro Baracci, and boy, there's a story, he and his son, saw a great deal of Pietro Baracci in Canberra during the pre-war years before Baracci, the Victorian government astronomer, was called in to manage the sighting and erection of the James Oddie telescope at Mount Stromlo. Deakin had a really interesting role in that as well. Baracci and Scrivener chose the location in March 1911, and by September the road to Stromlo was completed and the telescope was in place, enabling, and I'm quoting directly here, the meridian to which all surveys would be referred to be determined, courtesy of a fixed point on the summit. King O'Malley, a serial dreamer of ambitious dreams, the Minister for Home Affairs in the Fisher government from 1910 to 1913, a man bent on making Canberra, as he creatively put it at one point, hum, O'Malley was one step closer to achieving his national infrastructure goal of putting, to quote directly, the astronomical, meteorological and solar physical observatories in one single compound in the nation's capital. To conclude, I think we're smack on time, we are. When Charles Scrivener retired as the first Commonwealth Director of Lands and Surveys, the entire surveying and professional fraternity in Canberra turned out to bid him farewell. Actually, there were apparently a number of Melba-like farewells. Three Claude Vorton photos in the exhibition capture the mood very nicely indeed. On the 28th of May of the same year, Happy Harry Mowat and Fast Freddie Johnston met at Mowat's R87, looking at all you surveyors in the audience, R87 corner mark in the deep south of the Federal Capital Territory to finally complete the five-year exhausting and exhaustive survey. It was the end of an era. Just 7 weeks earlier, the diggers of the first AIF ran up the steep cliffs of the Gallipoli Peninsula and headlong into Turkish soldiers fighting for life and country. Australia would be forever changed as a result. Fred Johnston, by then a retired Commonwealth Surveyor General, wrote a book published in the early 1960s called Knights and Theodolites, an account of his family's surveying dynasty in Western Australia. It's a pretty dour read, one must say, but the foreword catches the attention, where a surveying colleague of Johnston's, Robert Fitzgerald, writes rather nostalgically, "We of the surveying fraternity are conscious of a long history behind us, of which, however, most of us know next to nothing. No one outside our little Freemasonry will ever really understand." In the exhibition to be opened here in the Parliament in a fortnight, the little Freemasonry gets a centenary hour or two in the sun. It is richly deserved. Charlie Scrivener and the many prodigiously talented men that he hired left an indelible mark on the city and the Australian Capital Territory containing it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, David. You tell a great story, not to mention doing a very good job of advertising the forthcoming exhibition. We do have a few minutes for questions or comments, and if you'd like to ask a question, can I ask you to come to one of the microphones in the middle or up in the gallery so that all of us can hear you?
This is not a question. It's a bit of trivia. Scrivener was in favour of the name Canberra for the capital city. However, he had great doubts that it would get up, and he actually bet his horse that it wouldn't, and he lost.
Thank Thereafter, you. I was aware that. Absolutely true. Griffith Taylor, in his diaries, tried to take credit for pushing the name Canberra and getting it up, but that was absolutely true, and thank you very much for that. And he did lose the bet. As he records, I believe, you know, somewhere I've read it, but certainly he records it himself that he lost that bet.
Are there any other questions or comments? Tony.
I hope it's nothing to do with Henry George, Tony, but I'm ready.
No, not today. David, the United States has had a great influence on the development of Australia as a federation. We have a Senate and we have a Senate here. I had thought, and maybe you could outline, that when we considered here in Australia a national capital, it was to be the same size as that of Washington, D.C. Was that right, or was that just a rumour?
Okay. Pretty much it was right. Certainly the thinking in the back end of the 1890s and over the turn of the century, there were many politicians who wanted that kind of minimalist model. And it will be in the exhibition. I should remember the exact date. I get them asked about, let me think now. I think it's the 19th of July, 1901. King O'Malley, who everyone thought was a bit of a joke, this is only 1901, and in some ways he was, you know, a humorous character, an eccentric character, that it would be O'Malley in 1901, and he would have quite a history in the National Capital story as a person who didn't believe in this site for many years but finally became a great believer, called it a new Eden, typical of O'Malley. But O'Malley moved that motion in July of 1901, and he called for 1,000 square miles. And that's where it gets interesting, because that immediately got the people in the parliament thinking about it, like it or lump it. And in O'Malley's case, because he'd had a rather checkered career in the United States before he arrived in Australia, and some of it was in real estate, was very conscious of the fact that unless you got a large area and it was leasehold land, then look out for the land sharks, for the developers. You know, it's going to happen in Australia as it happened in the United States. So it wasn't solely O'Malley, but he was the person who moved the motion. Barton had to respond to it as Prime Minister. There was a lot of debate. And from that point, you really had the kind of reinforcement of the idea of it being much bigger. And, of course, Scrivener, in his second report, would say that he wanted, you know, something in the zone of 1,000 square miles. The whole idea being two broad reasons. One, the O'Malley case. In other words, that you wanted to keep the land sharks out. And two, and that's where you're looking at the federal capital territory, the Australian capital territory we ended up with, and that was water catchment. Basically, chasing the water is why we go so far deeply south in the final analysis. Scrivener put forward, you know, he wanted Queanbeyan involved, etc. New South Wales wanted to hold on to Queanbeyan, and so they were looking and had to basically extend it to the south. It's putting it sort of simply, maybe even simplistically, but that was basically it.
Just a question about Scrivener's Hill. Why that particular hill, and what can you tell us?
It's an interesting one. We were trying to think, where do we put a plaque for the surveyors? And we were talking about Surveyor Hill. I think it was sort of serendipity, wasn't it? That I think I'm right in saying it's not particularly large. Alex, can you, you know, Surveyor's Hill, I mean, which is just to the south, and I should have... I don't think there was any overwhelming case in connection to the Surveyor story for the naming of that. It's not particularly big. Does anyone in the audience, and I've never pursued it. Just a trick station, yeah. Yeah. I think probably the answer is being a trig station, and with the Place Names Committee, it certainly wasn't in the period that I've been on the Place Names Committee, but would have come forward, and it seemed, you know, like a good idea to do it. Yeah. Yeah. I should put in a plug, just since we're talking about Surveyor Hill, for two plaques that went up earlier in the year, courtesy of the SSSI, the Surveying and Spatial Sciences Institute, and the Institute of Surveyors New South Wales, and that is that a plaque's gone up at Dunlop. Two plaques, in fact, and one in fairly bitter conditions at Mount Coree in May. We went there so that we could miss the worst of the weather, and it was a particularly tough day in the trenches, but nevertheless, those two went up earlier in the year as well. But sorry, it's not a particularly brilliant answer, but nevertheless... Yeah. Terrific. We'll have to do it this summer. I haven't seen the final plaque, so if you want to see that... Go to the top of Mount Coree to see the second of the recognitions of the great surveyor contribution.
Next question is from the gallery.
Hello, thank you very much.
Hey, Doug.
From my research, which is basically milling of Lake Valley River, the research that I to make a comment I wanted to make on the size of the city relates to the competition in 1911, where there is a clause that states that it was anticipated that the city would grow as the nation grew, so there would be that proportional size growth. And I think it's really useful as surveyors to think about then what is the boundary of the Canberra city versus the boundary of our territory. And I think it's a current debate that perhaps we should engage in. So thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Di. I'd only add that we certainly will be debating it, but there's been a little bit of lively exchange in the newspapers in recent weeks. But it is the case, and you might have seen that in the paper, that there are nominations in for particular areas of Canberra to be National Heritage listed, possibly for 2013. So I think it's a case of watch this space, because there will be debate about the areas. If there is going to be a National Heritage listing, what exactly should be National Heritage listed? And I really welcome that, because the sort of debate that we will be engaged in is going to be of the more elevated kind that was constantly about when you look, when you look at the history of 100 years ago. So keep an eye on that, because the nominations are in, the process has begun. There will almost certainly be a recommendation to the Minister towards the end of 2012. It remains to be seen what it will be, and a decision taken in 2013. So it should be a really interesting debate. And that's where you'll get so much of the fascination of the early history and the motivations early of people like O'Malley and Griffin and Marion, and so the list goes on, Charlie Scrivener. We get a better sense of them. We're going to learn much more, I think, between now and 2013.
We've got time for one more question, and it's up in the gallery. No.
Yes, maybe for Rosemary. I think it's only a matter. Straight off the top, I think it's only a matter of time that it is that the Parliament is heritage listed. I referred to it earlier in this talk as a magnificent building. I don't think it is as appreciated as it should be by the Australian population at this point. As you would know, there are only two World Heritage listed buildings in Australia now. One is the Opera House, as it should be, and the other, I'm pleased to say, in terms of the Federation centenary story, is the Royal Exhibition Building in Melbourne, which was purpose-built for the exposition in 1880, which then housed the next the exposition in 1888, and, of course, was the building that housed the opening of the Parliament in 1901. So it certainly deserves it, and it's getting its shape is better and better. Those two. I think it's only a matter of time till this one is. And I think the story of this building, and I know Aldo's a great, great mate and a great friend, but I know he and, say, Pamela Berg, and they're probably lunching now in the Parliament today to talk to a visiting group about the ideas that Aldo had in mind as he was sitting down in New York designing this particular place. And there are all sorts of wonderful stories attached to that. Aldo's told one or two of them. One is that he felt as he was drawing that he could have said Walter on one side and Marion on the other, very much looking down at his work as he drew. He was, at the very least, channeling some of the inspiration of the Griffins pretty much 100 years ago. I think that's important. But the other that's less well-known is the outstanding approach that was taken to the material inside the Parliament. People often say in Canberra that there isn't much that represents the Federation symbolically in Canberra. The Forestry School, I know, and I'm sure most of you here know, has wood taken from the states and territories there, from all of them. It was the case in the preliminary discussion and acquisition of artworks and materials for the Parliament House that all the people involved were intent on representing all of Australia. A really important point, and if you have a look at the Congress, or you get a hold of the Congress of 1901, have a look at George Sidney Jones's paper, but more importantly, the paper by the head of the Royal Horticultural Gardens, the Burnley Gardens in Melbourne in 1901, a guy called Charles Bogue Luffman, where brilliantly he talks about the need in the national capital to come that all of the regions of Australia are represented in that national capital. It's a sort of I've been everywhere man, but talking about the vegetation. It's absolutely superb. They were thinking about it then. We should be more conscious than ever of it now. And I think in light of the fact for the Parliament that the people involved were, but many Australians don't know they were, I think that's even more reason ultimately for getting heritage listed. I think it's inevitable that it will be.
Well, that's a big can of worms, and I think it's probably time to leave it today. Thank you very much, David, for a very stimulating and entertaining lecture. Thank you to you all for coming, and best wishes for the festive season. See you next year. Thank you.